Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
Today we wanted to focus on the flying fox, which is, they're all cool, but this one's really cool.
Yeah, and you definitely are going to want to stick with us because...
What can they teach us?
Interestingly enough, they are generally smart. Okay, that's just, generally, they exhibit curiosity to novel ideas.
Many species are in crisis and need your help.
Trouble, and I think if we let a lot of bat species go extinct, we're going to be in big trouble. And I just looked at.
Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
All right, welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angie.
Hello again from New Zealand, Angie.
Hello again from Florida, Chris.
Yeah, I haven't given up yet. I haven't gotten back on the boat to paddle home.
Don't blame you. The pictures I've seen on Facebook make it look pretty wonderful there.
Yeah. This weekend we were out at, I live about 30 minutes from Hobbiton where they filmed Lord of the Rings. It's Mata Mata. And yeah, it's just rolling hills, beautiful. It's summer, so the weather's great. It's been great.
It looks like there's lots of fun parks for the kids and nature walks.
Yes. It's been great for them. But anyway, jumping straight into the show. So I'm still in New Zealand, loving it. Plan on being here for a few years. And then, you know, who knows if I'll ever head back on the other side of the world. But today, we are going to talk about a species that, honestly, Angie, I have just been, wow, I didn't realize how bad it was. And it's really gotten me nervous. And I'm glad we're covering it. And that's bats. And specifically the flying fox.
Yes, Chris. I've been wanting to cover bats since we started the podcast. Besides their amazing physiology, right? They're flying mammals. They're the only...
Right.
Bats are the only mammals naturally capable of true sustained flight, unlike squirrels that can glide. So the physiology is just radical. And that's not a word I use often because I'm not from California. From California. So, but besides the physiology, their conservation issues that they face and some diseases are just really interesting. And I know a lot of our listeners that are animal lovers out there are going to learn a lot on this episode. And I think that they're, hopefully like you and I, they're going to be moved because it seems like you are extremely moved hearing about their conservation issues and some of the crisis that they're facing. And I had known a lot about that. But as I was reading it, it did make me kind of hold back the tears a little bit. But then on the brighter note is their physiology is so cool that I know we're going to inspire some people to want to help these guys out, want to learn more about them. And the neat thing about bats is they're found everywhere, right?
Right. Besides like pretty much.
The Arctic and Antarctic. I mean, so anybody listening to this, anywhere in the world – has a local bat species that's endemic to the area that they can learn more about how to help conserve them and learn more about their physiology.
Right. And we're going to talk about that today. And especially once we get later in the podcast, and I'll kind of talk a little bit about what's going on here in New Zealand, but just the conservation issues because bats are so critical to the environment. And reading some of this data, I just didn't realize how bad it was for them. I knew certain species were, I didn't realize like almost all of them were endangered. So we'll get there. But today we wanted to focus on the flying fox, which is, they're all cool, but this one's really cool.
Yeah, and you definitely are going to want to stick with us because Chris is going to cover some cool physiological facts, being how the heck they can hang upside down and
I know
not pass not, out. So be patient and you'll get to hear that. And there's tons of other really fun, interesting facts that I learned and that hopefully you all be learning today too.
Right. So the flying foxes are actually the largest bat in the world. And they're actually, some people may know them as fruit bats. I mean, today I'm going to just call them flying foxes, but some people do just say, hey, they're fruit bats because obviously, duh, that's what they eat. And we'll get to that in nutrition. There are over 1,200 species of bats, but specifically in flying foxes, there is 65, which is huge.
Yeah.
It's a huge different, you know, species. Many of them spread throughout, as you'll hear in their habitat here in a minute, spread on different islands throughout the Pacific, Southeast Asia, you know, and then stretching all the way to Africa.
Yeah, it's considered the old world tropics. I know we've covered that a little bit in primates, as far as New World being South and Central America and Old World being mostly Asia and some of Indonesia.
Hey, you're in the New World too. Don't forget Florida.
That's right. That's true. That's
so
true.
North America, yeah. So these bats are from the order Pteropus, which is the order of flying foxes. Now, just quickly in the beginning, I always, again, like to give a description. Most people, I think, have an idea of what a bat looks like, or at least a vampire, right? I mean, from myths and legends and stuff. So this is a mammal, as Angie said, and they actually have two arms and legs. It's just the arms and their legs are attached to wings, which is just amazing. I mean, it's amazing how these animals, mammals, fly.
And even more specifically, it's actually their fingers that are the elongated bones that actually are the wing part.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually right in on my computer screen. I have a picture of a flying fox with the sunlight. And I'll put this one up on the show notes for sure. And you can see the finger bones. It's and the, you know, the blood vessels that keep that skin healthy. But yeah, I'm just looking at this thing going, wow, it's an amazing creature.
It's a really interesting adaptation. I had a cousin that had webbing between his feet, and I always thought that was so cool because he could like swim better. And you know, this is just a glorified version of evolution at its finest, where they just started becoming more successful the longer these finger digits grew and the more they were able to fly. And there's a lot of researchers that have different hypotheses of why that would be a good evolutionary strategy. And that goes along too with them being nocturnal, that flying helps them obviously move and find food a lot faster and get away from predators. And then being at night, hunting at nighttime, they have less competition, right? Nobody should. Right. Nothing good happens past 2 a.m. That's what I think a song says or my mom used to say or something.
Yeah, mom says,
But for bats, it's the opposite. There's nobody out. Yeah. So it really, the nighttime is where they really thrive.
Right, right. And I think that leads into some of the myths of being scary and whatnot. But really quick, I didn't know Michael Phelps was your cousin. I've known you for a long time.
I wish. Right? I wish I had those swimming genes in my family. Man, I was on the swim team, and I was not the fastest, but I was most improved, and I was a team captain. So they said I had a lot of heart and very little skill, I think was the consensus after a few years. So I was a distance swimmer, so not a sprinter like Michael Phelps. And my cousin never swam with those web toes. And so
missed opportunities.
I know. But Chris, you know what's really fascinating for the viewers out there that haven't gone to the show notes to see a flying fox is that it really is quite cute. And one of the reasons it's called a flying fox or fruit bat, but flying fox, is because its face looks like a fox, which is pretty adorable. Yeah. And I was reading last night that some people describe it, put your seatbelt on, as a flying German Shepherd puppy. like the face is so cute.
Yeah. That is like perfect description.
Sure. And that's why for doing bats, they're kind of a fun species of bat to start with. Hopefully throughout in the next so many years, you and I will cover many different bats.
For sure.
I like the flying fox besides its size. And I know you'll get more into that in a little bit. It's also just really kind of cool to look at. It's big. It's got a furry face. And it's also known as what's considered a mega bat. And where a lot of bats are what are termed micro bats. And there's
it'd be a good spot. Maybe you can jump. Yeah, I'm jumping in a bit. You know, get in the description of them. But yeah, explain what is the difference between a mega and a micro bat? Because I think that's a great way to kind of start people in their minds, start kind of separating these animals out.
Sure. I mean, these were new terms for me when I started researching bats. But just generally speaking, mega bats are consistent of flying foxes or fruit bats, and they eat fruit or nectar from fruit. And probably the biggest difference between megabats or flying foxes and most all the other species of bats or microbats is that megabats have a really powerful sense of smell and really good eyes, really big eyes, like those German Shepherd puppies. Aw, we need like an aw button.
Yeah, so cute. I know, they're so cute.
Mm-hmm. But the difference is microbats use echolocation. And mm-hmm. we all have learned growing up from science classes or movies or whatever that bats use this echolocation to help find right. their prey, which is true in most species of bats, the insectivores. Right. However, megabats or the flying foxes don't use that.
Wow. So, yeah. So they don't really echolocate at all.
No.
Huh?
There's one species that does. It's called the Egyptian fruit bat. It's an exception. Mm. But the form of echolocation that it uses is nowhere near as sophisticated as what microbats use or the bats we have here in North America.
Right. Yeah. And it's just, I mean, sitting here thinking about bat, you know, I'm going to get into a little bit of bat evolution, thinking about how the bigger bats don't echolocate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're probably, you know, hunting strategies. So they wouldn't, even if they could echolocate, they're probably not fast enough to catch insects, where these little microbats just zip around the sky.
Sure. And, yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
And then just generally, these megabats or flying foxes that all live in the old world tropics, they don't hibernate, where microbats will go into some form of hibernation.
Mm-hmm.
And or not all species, but some of them. And then the megabats have an extra hook claw, probably for helping mm-hmm. to grasp the fruit. So yeah, just a few differences. At your next cocktail party, you guys can talk about the difference between be the coolest person in the room talking about microbats and megabats. Although you would, I need to talk to my 4-year-old Xander about this because he's really into Batman. So he would probably he'll probably really enjoy this episode.
Yeah. No, it's crazy because I know later in the show, you know, maybe Luby is one of your organizations, but Luby Bat Foundation is right outside Gainesville. And, you know, I've gotten a personal tour, private tour. I know you have been there every year. They have stuff around Halloween. I wish we would have done this episode before that because I want to go back there. And I know they're working with some of the most endangered bats in the world. But I know looking at these, you know, fruit bats or flying foxes, I just have such a great appreciation now for them after reading all this mm-hmm. stuff.
And that's one of the reasons why I picked them was because of this Luby Conservation Center for bats that, surprise, surprise, is one of the organizations I'll be talking about a little bit later.
Good.
But yes, I've been there multiple times and I just love their flying fox exhibits and I read like everything they have to say about them. And they do a lot of really cool non-invasive research there to learn more about their behavior because little is known about them in the wild.
Right.
So yeah, they're definitely definitely a bat hero internationally in the industry.
Yeah, they're great. They're great.
And next time I go back there, Chris, maybe I can put you on like FaceTime video so we can walk through together. Since you have that high fiber internet there down in New Zealand, you're all fancy
suckers.
Now.
I know. 100 megs per second. Jeez. Compared to the crud I had back in the States. All right, so flying foxes. Like you said, size, wingspan's almost 5 feet. So a little bit shorter than you.
Mm-hmm, and some of the larger ones, yes.
Yeah, like 1.5 meters, just huge, huge wingspan. Coats, like I think the German Shepherd puppy's perfect. But the reddish brown, reddish gray, or even black brown, you know, looking at all the different subspecies of them, you know, trying to look. And then again, they just have those two short ears and large eyes that make them look like foxes, you know, mm-hmm. thus the name. Now, like Angie said, these are old world bats, so they're only found in parts of Africa, so Eastern Africa, running into India, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Australia, big populations there, and then some of the Pacific Islands have them.
So none in New Zealand?
No. And we're going to get to New Zealand and our bat problem, because we only have one species of bat left. You know, we lost one of the other ones. Yeah, we'll get there. So in the flying foxes, again, you know, going into bats overall, there's 16 major families of bats, and flying foxes are part of these megabat family. To get to some of the numbers, like I said earlier, just wow on how many of these things are threatened with extinction. Scientists estimate there's over 1,200 species of bats, and of course, we're still discovering new species here and there, so there may be a little bit more than that.
Which, interestingly enough, Chris, as far as bats go, the 1,200 plus species, they comprise about 20% of all classified mammals worldwide.
Wow.
So it's a big chunk of mammals.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I didn't really think about that. You're right. Because it's, you know, there are so many of them and so many different subspecies.
At least right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that if you break it down, 26 are right now critically endangered, meaning they're heading towards extinction or they're already extinct. We just haven't fully classified them as extinct yet. 52 are endangered, and then 954 are threatened with extinction. So they're trending downward, right? Populations are trending downward. So almost every bat species on Earth, with exception of a very few, is threatened with extinction. So I just read that and looking at the IUCN stats, and I was just like, are you got to be kidding me? Like, I really, you know, since we've done this, and I know I'm doing a lot of research and reading, you know, each week now that, you know, when my kids are, you know, off playing somewhere and I get a few minutes to look some things up, and I'm really looking at these mass extinction statistics. And I, next to amphibians, bats are the next thing that I'm like, holy smokes, we're in big trouble. We're in big trouble.
Yes, Chris. No, and it's a problem for so many reasons that we don't have necessarily on this individual podcast the ability to get into. But as far as bats go, like I said, comprising about 20% of mammals in general, bats, yes, I think these flying foxes are cute and there's lots of stories and myths about them, which I'll touch on in a little bit. But there's some really, 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 just to stress it, important reasons to conserve bats.
Yep.
Which we're trying to do, but we're not doing very well overall. Mm-hmm. And so there's about four or five super important reasons. And I'm just going to run through them really quick to give you the bullet list. But it's important to know that bats act as pest control because they're insectivores. They act as pollinators because a lot of them feed on nectar. So they move pollen from one flower or plant to the next. They act as seed dispersal for the fruit-eating bats. And their feces, guano, or bat droppings, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of, is a really valuable and rich source of natural fertilizer. And just in general, because of all of these things, they're known as a keystone species, which we've talked about before, that they help determine how healthy or unhealthy an ecosystem is with their if they're able to survive or not. So those are the general bullet points of why we should conserve them. But I'm going to dive a little bit deeper because I'm a farmer's daughter and I'm proud of that. Grew up in the farming industry. But these statistics I was unaware of. So moving back to bats as a pest control agent, the insectivore bats, which primarily insects at nighttime, are night flying insects.
Right.
A pregnant or nursing mother of these bat species can consume up to their body weight in insects each night. Okay. So that's a lot of bats.
So yeah, some of them, that's almost like they're less than a pound, but a pound of insects?
Exactly.
That's insane.
That's incredible, okay?
Oh
and
my God.
So thinking about agriculture and why I bring this up, it's been estimated, Chris, that bats can save the agricultural industry just in the U.S., okay? That's where the stats are coming out of. Anywhere from $3.7 billion to $53 billion per year, okay? So 3.7 billion to 53 billion per year in pesticides and helping the crops use less pesticides with the bats controlling the insects.
Okay? So just to kind of follow up with that, it's not just an economical consideration, which is huge because, you know, being a farmer's daughter, you know, farming, you don't get rich. Most farmers are not rich. They're eking out a living, most of them. You know, not these factory farms, blah, blah, blah. We don't need to go into that. But it's not just the economical savings. It's less pesticides. That is the big thing.
Exactly.
Less poisons. Or even if we're using these natural herbicides, you know, we're taking care of our food. And less chemicals.
Sure. And farmers don't want to use pesticides in general because that's not good for the environment. And they cost the farmer a lot of money. They're one of the biggest costs for my family farm. And so if we can use more of these bats to do the work for us, you know, why the heck not? In Mexico.
Sorry, I don't mean to jump in again real quick. This makes, you know, and I'm just brainstorming right here. Maybe, you know, we can notch this, you know, for later for me and you to investigate. Maybe we should be pushing farmers to build bat houses, you know, build bat houses.
Seriously. Absolutely.
You know, that mm-hmm. would help.
There's yeah. new, yeah, no, I saw a company a few weeks ago that will basically ship you a really big and a really awesome bat house that you can construct on your property. Yeah. So maybe we'll have to put those up on our show.
Yeah,
show
yeah, notes. That's something we should be pushing. But, okay, sorry.
No, but it's. I mean, for instance, the Mexican free-tailed bat in Texas, it eats this corn earworm moth. Mm. And just this bat alone in Texas, it's estimated that it saves farmers an economic value of $1 billion
wow.
a year.
Wow.
$1 billion a year.
And that's just in the U.S.
So, sure. Right. Yeah. Exactly. So I think it's just something that I hadn't really put two and two together of how much hard work these bats are doing, especially like the insectivores, mm-hmm. and just something that I feel like there must be a way for us to work together, and there could be a huge collapse if we lose these guys.
Oh yeah, that's where it's like I was just next to the amphibians, which are in worse straits, I guess more dire straits than bats, and they're such an important part of the food chain or food web. Bats are another key, like you said, keystone species. And just looking at the 65 species of flying foxes, half are endangered, classified as endangered. And some that have gone extinct is the small Mauritian flying fox. That went extinct in the 1800s. The dusky flying fox went extinct in the late 1800s, and that was in Australia. The large Paliou flying fox, late 1800s on that island. And then one recent, and this is where we get some data of recent impacts because it is a U.S. territory, and that's Guam. And the Guam fruit bat went extinct in the early 1970s. And so later, I'm going to kind of sum up what are some of the things they're seeing with that. Now, again, we're going to touch a little bit more on conservation towards the end, getting back into kind of specifically flying fox. And this bat species, it's really interesting looking at their evolution, and I'm just going to kind of, again, Cliff Notes version of this. Bat evolution, they stretch about 52 million years is mm-hmm. the first indication of bats. And like I said, I was, and maybe some of these factoids will leak out over the few coming pods because I'm really researching the mass extinctions that have gone on. And, the end of the KPG extinction, the 65 million years ago, the fifth mass extinction, the non-avian dinosaurs went extinct. The only avian dinosaurs to come out were birds. So a lot of the other ones did die out, but birds did come out of that. And then the mammals survived, then obviously some reptiles and things like that. So the flying mammal really, there was nothing before the fifth mass extinction in the geological record. What's interesting about bat evolution is it's hard to trace because their bones are so brittle.
Right. I was reading that they're very delicate and skeletons of the bats just don't generally fossilize well. In fact, I read somewhere it was estimated that only 12% of bat species that lived have ever been found in the fossil record.
Right. And that makes sense.
They're making a lot of guesses. Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes sense because they're flying mammal, right? So they can't have these big, heavy set bones. It's too much weight and they can't fly with that. So the earliest fossil dates back 52 million years and it is Onychonteris finnegi. Hey, I did it.
That wasn't too bad. It was a little painful to listen to.
Thanks.
Just kidding.
Thanks a lot. I'm going to stop. Stop recording. What?
No, you're gonna make me start saying them, and that's when we're gonna have real problems because I have
Onychonteris finnegi. Okay, yeah, that one's pretty big, mouthful. Yeah, okay, but they didn't really think they could really sustain flight. They fluttered, they gliding. So thinking about evolution and these adaptations that help them, they really think it helped them escape predators, things like that. Mm-hmm. So. But yet didn't develop echolocation. That was what it was interesting. They didn't have the ear bones that they did. So they describe it more as flying foxes. Okay. So I kind of think, flying foxes are linked to the oldest bat species. Reading about some of the evolution, I'm thinking why did these animals just all of a sudden want to start flying? And they think that they were kind of slower and they were these sit and wait predators. And then when their prey came around, they wrapped their arms around them. Mm. and ate them, or, you know, grabbed an insect, or grabbed, I don't think they ate mammals, or they're not meat eaters per se. So over time, you know, say someone like your cousin, if he had webbed fingers and were out in the wild.
It was his toes, okay? It wasn't that weird. And I think it was like only like three toes.
That's okay. It's okay. I've heard of that before. But think of somebody, if we're out in the wild with webbed fingers and we eat insects, and they could grab insects a lot easier with webs,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
So those people would be more successful, and plus they'd get more of the hotties because people think how cool they are with their webbed fingers.
And
they would breed and pass on their genetics, right?
Oh, we'll get into some of that in breeding behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyways, so that's where they think they started developing these membranes. Then they could glide, almost like sugar gliders today, mm-hmm, and then develop the ability to fly. Now, the flying foxes specifically, some of this data is, again, hard because there's not a rich fossil record, but they think they emerged about 14 million years ago, Southeast Asia, and the current species today, about 8 million years. So they've been around for a while.
Sure.
I mean, they're a pretty old species on Earth. The only relative, I was like looking up, okay, where's the biggest bat ever found?
And you love this. You're so good at this part.
Yeah, like, you know, that giant saber-toothed cat the size of a horse. Oh, my God. So where do you think they found this huge walking bat? If you had to guess, anywhere in the world.
I'm going to guess. I'm going to take the easy route. I'm going to guess North America, because it seems like a lot of weird.
No.
A lot of weird stuff
walking
happens in North America way back in the day. And actually.
It still does.
I was going to say, actually, right now as we speak. Yes. Okay, so second guess. Walking.
I mean, you know, it walks. It can't fly,
okay,
really.
Africa.
Where would they be safe? Where would they be safe? Do I need to show my camera outside to give
sure,
you a clue?
Sure, can we? Yeah, this is a really horrible game of like charades. Australia.
Look outside my window.
New Zealand.
New Zealand.
Yay! Thank you for the charades.
So
I'm
yeah,
at your window.
New Zealand, because New Zealand actually has a lot of wildlife, birds specifically, that are flightless.
Oh, cool!
Because there's no predators. So think about it. A walking bat is lunch for a honey badger.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't survive there.
I would say an appetizer, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, same thing. North America, but in New Zealand, a lot of these species evolved not to fly because they didn't need to, really. So this was kind of a glider. Didn't really have sustained flight. So this was over 16 million years ago. Mystacina myosinalis. Okay.
Beautiful.
So they were almost twice as heavy as flying foxes. Not quite. They didn't have like a 12-foot wingspan. Their wingspan was probably like 6 feet. Out of the one thing I want to say, maybe this would be a good segue into humans. Of the 1,200 bat species, only three suck on blood or are considered carnivorous, right? So really the myths of bats being these evil things is just a bunch of hooey.
Sure, sure. And a lot of it's propagated just by our culture. And you know, in Europe and North America, bats are associated with darkness and witchcraft and death and, you know, spooky, eerie things like vampires. But in other countries, for instance, in China, bats are often associated with happiness, joy, and good fortune. So it does depend on what you're back, you know, what native region you're looking at to see how you've been exposed to bats. But I know we grew up always fearing bats or thinking, you know, and growing up, there was a bat in our house. And like my mom, bless her heart, mom, I love you. And just for the record, for all my listeners out there, my mom loves the podcast. However, Chris, she says we talk too fast. And I told her,
Angie.
I know. It's only because I'm so excited. So I'm trying to slow it down for my mom.
Okay,
however,
sorry, mom. We'll do it.
Sorry, mom. Working on it. It's a work in progress. But there was a bat that came from our attic and it was like all HELL hockey sticks broke loose. And I, you know, you're 6 years old and you see your mom freaking out and you freak out too. And so I think that's, and then of course in movies and cinema and then people worried about the diseases they can transmit. So they have an uphill battle, kind of like sharks, you know, they're just notorious.
Yeah.
They're just notorious bad guys. But more specifically with the flying fox, they've been traditionally in general, just regard it as pests. Because they make a lot of noise, they can contaminate and defecate and urinate in water supplies. They, of course, sometimes raid fruit orchards, and a lot of places just generally don't like them. In different parts of the world, too, flying foxes know that humans don't like them, and they'll often squeal with displeasure when they see a human present. So there's kind of this human fruit bat or flying fox bat conflict that's goes on depending on the different countries. And what's really interesting is in Australia, the Kiwis, bless their hearts, they in the 19-
No. Not gonna stop you. New Zealand is the Kiwis.
Okay. Oh, is it really?
Yeah, they're the wallabies.
Oh,
they're
okay.
The kangaroos and the koalas. Yeah, no way. Okay. Kiwi,
Okay.
That's Zealand.
Got it. See, looking at we're all learning here, right?
I think it's hilarious, but yeah, there's something between the Kiwis and Aussies with that. So anyways.
That's so funny. Well, sorry if I offended any New Zealanders out there, but I learned a lot and it's burned in my mind and I'll never do that again. So anyway, but interesting enough, so Australia, the Aussies.
Yes.
In the 1920s, they brought in a British biologist to kind of look into the flying fox or the fruit bat situation in their commercial fruit crops. And they wanted this guy to help them figure out how to eliminate them or call them, if you will. And so this guy's studying them and then you got to love science, because his research proved that the assumptions the flying fox is a menace to the commercial fruit industry is definitely false, and that the loss of commercial fruit to the crop is so negligible that it's almost trifling, to use his words, end quote. And he found out that honestly that most of the damage being done to the fruit was by monkeys. And that they were the culprits, and that these poor flying foxes were being, you know, hunted and called inaccurately.
Sorry to jump in, it's because I mean, get my elephant plug in, but hearing that, it made me think of Alan Savory, who in he was Angola or Southwest Africa, and he went in and said, "Oh, the elephants are, you know, causing desertification. You need to cull all your elephants because they're ruining the environment." They go in and slaughter 40,000 elephants. Oh, and then years later, he comes back and says, "Oops, made a mistake." It was because desertification actually picked up pace.
Mm-hmm.
The elephants were actually
helping
with seed dispersal and helping sustain the environment. When you took the elephants away, then that environment just it turned into a desert.
Well, and that's exactly it with these flying foxes. Yeah. Is that okay? Yes, they're going to eat some fruit here and there. But in the same instance, they're doing a lot of seed dispersal, of course, of fruits. Yeah. Now, farming's a little bit more commercialized, but they eat fruits of the tropical trees in forests. So with all this habitat loss going on and deforestation, that keeping bats around will actually help new growth of forestation as they're flying around dispersing their seeds. And they've shown that areas that have a healthy fruit bat population, they have a lot more regrowth of their clear-cut forests.
Right. Yeah.
So I vote to keep them. But there is, you know, unfortunately, there is this human flying fox conflict in some places and some countries, and then other countries like not the Kiwis, but in Australia, other countries like the Aussies have taken a real stance, and they draw a pretty hard line and don't allow any illegal poaching of them, and if you do that, it'll put you in jail with some gnarly fines.
Right.
So different countries handle it differently, and some countries and some regions are taking note of how important they are, both economically but also to the habitat, to the environment.
Right, and you know, just kind of jumping into how long these creatures live, they live about 15 years in the wild, you know, so they've lived pretty long, this type of species or type of animal.
They've been up to 25 years in a captive setting too, so even longer. It's really interesting, Chris, that bats in general, so microbats and megabats, their maximum lifespan is 3.5 times longer than any other mammals of their size.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy.
And there was a male Brandt's bat. I'm not sure. I think that's probably a micro bat. But it was recaptured in the wild after 41 years. In the wild.
Holy smokes. Wow.
I think we're still learning a lot about them. But in general, yeah, they have a pretty long life cycle for a mammal.
Yeah, yeah. So the largest flying fox is Pteropus vampirus. So I heard that. I saw vampirus. I'm like, what, vampire bat? I mean, these things don't suck blood at all, right? I mean, they don't. So it weighs 1.5 to 2.5 pounds or almost a kilogram. This is the 5-foot wingspan. Their body is about 30 centimeters or a foot long. And these are from Indonesia.
Okay.
Now, like Angie said at the beginning, really some unique physiology. They hang and sleep upside down for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm. That position is called roosting.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And they just hang there and they're cool. And that's what most people look up and see a fox a flying fox or a bat hanging upside down. So they, we'll talk about here in a second how they do that. They wrap their wings around their bodies to warm themselves. And then which is cool, I've seen at Luby, you walk by and their wings are spread open when they're trying to sun themselves, and get some warmth. And again, these are warm-blooded, so they're not like reptiles where they need the sun. But you see them hanging and they'll flare their wings out. It's really, really cool. So how do the bats survive upside down? Getting to that question, because I was interested. I'm like, how the heck do they do that? If I do it, I'm dead.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. All that brain will pool in your blood.
No, I try to do a handstand in yoga. Forget about it.
Yeah. Or all that blood will pool in your brain because we have about 2 gallons of blood in our body. So when we're upside down, all of that blood pushes and rushes to our head, right? So that's where some people will pass out, and that's a body mechanism. So then maybe you'll become laying down. But if you're in sustained upside down, you will die. You can die from that. But really, it's easy physics, is bats are so much smaller and they have so much less blood that gravity doesn't affect it. So it doesn't rush to their head, which is really interesting. I'm like, do they have some countercurrent pump or something? No, it's just they're small enough that the blood doesn't rush to their brains like it does for us.
So it's just like a slow drip and their brain can deal with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and they pump it and it's no biggie. So I thought that was a simple answer,
Ackman's razor. That's what.
Yeah.
There's like a theme.
Word of the day.
Yeah.
Word of the day.
Okay, cool.
And then, and then they have specialized tendons that kind of lock their toes in place, so they can hang indefinitely. I read that one study actually found dead bats that were still hanging.
Oh,
it just locks them up there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And if they die, but yeah, I mean, getting into their behavior and their ecological role, I mean, they're so critical to what's going on.
Oh, yeah. Looking at flying fox behavior, first, it's important to note that their social structure is typically in colonies. However, there are some that I found was really interesting that are solitary. They don't have the big colonies like you see with most flying foxes. For instance, it's called the Samoan flying fox out of the Samoan Islands. It's a solitary creature, unless it's breeding. But most of them are going to live in groups or these large colonies. And unlike their cousins, the microbats, they're not in caves or dark places. As you and I had mentioned before, that we in North America, we tend to like to have bat houses where bats will go and hang out in colonies, and then we can watch them fly away after dusk, which is one of my favorite activities to do here in Florida, in Gainesville, Florida, where I live. We have a really cool bat house on University of Florida on their campus. Yeah. It was established in 1991, and it's I don't know if it still is, but for many years it held the title as the largest bat house in the country. And
And the other one real quick, Austin is known. Austin, Texas is a big place if you ever want to see bats under these bridges.
Sure.
And at night, there's usually thousands of people watch these bats.
Yeah, I've seen those ones too there. Yeah, and seen walked under the guano.
Yeah. Don't look up with your mouth open, right?
Yeah, No. Wear your goggles. But collect some. It's really good fertilizer.
Yeah.
So typically the flying foxes are just going to be in trees, and that's where they roost or hang upside down in that posture known as roosting. And when they're in these large groups, I thought it was really kind of cool. It's called camps. So flying foxes roost in trees in a group of called camps to use it in a sense.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, but unfortunately for these guys, it kind of makes them an easy target for hunters because they're not in a cave or a bat house or under a bridge. They are like out wide open in a tree. Now, interestingly enough, some of the flying foxes will, instead of being way out in the open, they'll try to hide behind leaves or build what they call like a leaf tent to try to at least hide a little bit, but not all the species do that. And their communication is one of the reasons that they've been known to be a pest, because they're actually really noisy.
Yeah.
They have, during their feeding aggregations, you're just going to hear a lot of chirping and barking and howling. And a lot of this is, even though they're used to their colony and their friends, they don't want to touch each other either when they're roosting or when they are, of course, on their fruit getting nectar. You know, it's like, this is mine. So they'll talk to each other, but it can be very loud and noisy. And their territorial behavior is just going to include them growling, if you will, which is kind of funny to visualize. I mean, if you think of a fox.
Yeah.
Growling. And then, but then also spreading their wings to look bigger and tougher. And they may even, if the interaction accelerates, they might even do some thumb and wrist sparring or make slightly louder vocalizations. And if you'll bear with me, I think I have something. So this is a vocalization of a gray-headed flying fox. They are from Australia.
No, that's I can really hear that. I remember hearing some of that at Luby. So pretty complex, you know, vocalization. So how does that translate into, I guess, intelligence?
Ooh, Chris, you asked my favorite question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? I didn't know that.
Yeah, okay. No, it really, as I've been doing these animals each week, I've just been learning. I'm always fascinated about how intelligent they are, and but yet how little we know, if you will. And right. So, I don't know, all you young budding animal behavior scientists out there listening, hopefully there's lots of you, man, go when you're in college, hit up your local biology professor and say, can I do a study on how intelligent animals are? Because interestingly enough, they are generally smart. Okay. That's just, I'll just generally, they exhibit curiosity to novel items or new items. And they also can recognize individual people who will enter their enclosures in a captive setting. But there's really not a lot of quantitative research, okay? And so this is what I'm saying for, you know, a lot, and if there are any college students or even high school students out there listening, this young student at the University of Florida, I have to brag a little bit, his name is Nathan, and he was working for a psychology professor named Dr. Clive Wynn, I think I'm saying that right, here at UF. And this professor was super interested in intelligence of animals, but he worked more with domestic animals, dogs, cats, and what have you. So him and Nathan somehow got together. Nathan was, I think, an undergrad. It was definitely an undergrad. Maybe, I don't know if he was biology or what. And they decided to take some of their testing of domestics to Luby Conservation Center here in Gainesville. And they worked with the scientists and the zookeepers there to design a really well done, if I do say so myself, experimental design to test the intelligence, the social intelligence of flying foxes. I do not know which specific species, so unfortunately, I'll have to find that out. I'll have to ask that the next time I go there. But what they did is they designed a study where they made two bucket things that looked exactly the same that the bats had to go into to receive a fruit or nectar treat. And they found that the bats very, very readily were able to respond to a human pointing cue. Okay. And in the literature, in animal behaviorist literature, when you point to an object, and so what this is called is this is human-like social intelligence, cognition, meaning that the bats were able to understand what the human was saying when he was pointing to the bucket that had the treat in it. And there was no other cue and no other way for the bat to know which bucket had the treat in it except for when the researcher would point to it. And we all know they have dogs, right, and maybe even cats. We all know cats can be a little, you know, snarky. But you know, if you just a little.
Just a little.
But you know, you know that if you point somewhere for a dog, he's going to pick up that Cheerio. Like, he know, like, we have a comment, and they're tuned into us. And it's on the higher level of intelligence. And so I think it was something like 80 or 90% of the bats instantly figured out, like, okay, the human's showing me where to go.
Where?
Mm-hmm. Which is really
cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, it really hasn't been documented much in you know, definitely in, this was the first time ever in bats, but in not too much in exotic animals in general. So I think it goes to show there's a lot more research that needs to be done to see how their intelligence lies. And some people compare them even in, from evolutionary terms on a similar scale with some species of primate. So, I mean, there's, you know, they're definitely super cool creatures worth saving, you ask me. And then I just keep visualizing that cute little German Shepherd puppy flying fox like thing, and me pointing to the treats and it like chirping and loving me. Obviously, nobody, I'm not a promoter of having bats as pets. We all know that.
But
trying to give people an idea that they're not these scary, blood sucking things with no brains. They have a lot of feelings and a lot of and a lot of intelligence.
Right. Now, jumping into nutrition, I mean, it's very simple. They, all species of flying foxes, they only eat some fruit, obviously, because they're fruit bats too. Nectar, blossoms, and pollen, which, you know, kind of goes into conservation on why they are so important. Again, Angie was talking about seed dispersal, pollinating plants. You know, it's not just like everybody's concerned about honeybees. You know, that's why we're here in New Zealand, because my wife's researching honeybees down here. What, you know, these play a very, very critical role. And the reason flying foxes are in such trouble is, again, like Angie said, with deforestation, because they need those trees for shelter and food. And the trees are dependent on the foxes for seed dispersal and pollination. So it's this, you know, cohabitation that they both need each other. And without one or the other species goes away. You know, you start collapsing that food web and that food chain. Now, Angie did go quite a bit into how bats benefit us. Around the world, these flying foxes, again, are hunted for food. Deforestation, so one of the things is in Indonesia, Southeast Asia, palm oil is a big booming business down there, so they're just clearing forests. And again, read up on orangutans, and hopefully this year we can get to orangutans. You know, we really need to jump into another primate. They are in big trouble because they're losing their habitat.
Right, in this household, in our family household, we try to shop palm-free oil, which is hard.
Yeah.
It's not easy. But there's all sorts of apps out there.
It's in everything.
But for Halloween candy, we try to always do palm oil-free. And it's just something to be aware of. I mean, nobody's perfect. I definitely have some palm oil products in my house right now, for sure. You can't be perfect with everything, but you can try and you can be made aware of some of these crises. And Chris, that's really interesting. I've followed the orangutan crisis closely, but I didn't even put two and two together about the bats in the palm oil.
Yeah. I mean, they're just losing everything. And this one, you know, not specifically flying foxes, but bats in general, wind farms, which, as we try to develop sustainable energy, you know, carbon neutral energy, wind farms are killing a lot of birds and bats.
I don't. It makes me so sad. I'm like, why can't we win? Can't we catch a break?
I know. There's ways that there's things out there. We just have to find them. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, their decline is because of humans. I mean, there's no doubt. And the one is the Guam flying fox that I talked about earlier. You know, they've been removed, and there's really, it's invasive species, the brown snakes.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone and just decimated the population of native species on Guam.
The Guam rail is a bird species we should cover.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is functionally extinct in the wild, but through captive breeding efforts has a lot of some of their populations rebounded.
Yeah. It's so Guam, the biome on Guam's collapsing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, native plants there. One study I read cited there's 40 times more spiders on Guam compared to their nearby islands. So if you like spiders, go to Guam. There's plenty of them. So yeah, the balance of nature's out of whack, and we're seeing the consequences there. So I cannot say this enough. You know, and if you get anything out of this podcast, it's not so much how cool flying foxes are. It's just bats are so critical to the cog. I call them a cog in the machine of nature, like Angie called them a keystone species. We got to talk about these guys more. They're in big trouble. And I think if we let a lot of bat species go extinct, we're going to be in big trouble. And I just looked at, you know, what are the most endangered bats? And some of these have already gone extinct, like the Christmas Island pipistrelle. That bat's been declared extinct last year. The sheath-tailed bat has been declared extinct. And then the New Zealand greater short-tailed bat. So that one went extinct. Now the lesser short-tailed bat, and I got to give a shout-out to my new friends here. I have two new friends that are working in conservation.
Chris is Jesse making friends. Yay!
Yeah.
That's pretty easy. You're a pretty friendly guy.
Thanks. Jesse's awesome. He's amazing. We're actually going to go catch crickets.
Are you guys going on a mandate? So, yeah. Oh, you're going on a mandate.
Yeah.
Ooh, the pressure's on. That's awesome. Fun.
So I got to give a shout out to his girlfriend, Bryn. She just two weeks ago, and she did this on her own. She looked up who was doing bat research. Jesse was driving home, and New Zealand's very. You get outside the towns, it's pretty mm-hmm. remote, and she had her GPS out. She told Jesse where to go. She's like, drop me off. She waved, gave him a hug, a kiss, whatever, and off he went. She just left her in the middle of nowhere, and she knew where she was, and she went and met this bat researcher, and so they were catching and tagging bats, these lesser short-tailed bats. So the New Zealand government is working really hard that this is one of their priorities, is to save the species of bat. So
yes,
that's good.
We love when the government gets on board. It makes it not perfect, but better.
No, and that's, you know, part of this, Angie, you know, you've already alluded to it. We talked about the palm oil. So my conservation tip of the week was just, you can use sustainable palm oil. There is apps out there. I think it's the Columbus Zoo. One of the zoos had put out an ethical palm oil app, so you can check to see if that's coming from somewhere where they haven't clear-cutted, you know, native habitat for some of these species. Or, like Angie said, there's ones that you can use that, you know, to eliminate palm oil. But I think if we start voting with our dollar, you know, we're going to let companies know that we care about the environment and sustainability, and so they're going
to
be
we need to make it like stuff. Cool to be sustainable palm oil, like that's the goal. And be aware and get people talking about it and having some of these conversations, because a lot of people don't put two and two together that palm oil has anything to do with orangutans or with flying foxes.
Right. So who should we be supporting this week? I know we've already been talking about Luby.
Chris, my first shout out for my conservation organization of the week has to go to Luby Bat Conservancy. And
yay.
That's, I know, right?
We love them.
Just
we
down the
them.
Road in Gainesville, yeah. Florida. And so Luby is L-U-B-E-E. And you can find them, of course, on the internet, or they have a wonderful Facebook page. Like them, be friends with them. They're really awesome. And what their goal is they're an international nonprofit organization dedicated to saving bats. Of course, they use research, conservation, and education, and they always focus on community engagement, which we're really lucky to know that, because they engage in our community. And we're really lucky here in Gainesville that we get to have a lot of their community output and engagement, because we get to visit their facility. What Luby is a research and conservation breeding center that houses over 200 fruit bats, obviously some flying fox species. Mm-hmm. And they have lots of goals. They like to use many cross-disciplinary studies, and they use collaborative research on bat biology and ecology, and they promote and train scientists. So that's how they get hooked up with a lot of these undergrads and or professors at different universities. And they study bat biology, genetics, physiology, and ecology. And they're the ones that helped host that really cool study about the intelligence of flying foxes, that they're as intelligent, if not more than your dog, or have some similarities to it. And then, of course, they like to transfer knowledge about bats and bat conservation through informal science educations. So I highly recommend you check out their webpage. When I moved to Gainesville, it was one of my happiest moments and surprises was learning about this institute. And of course, my husband works with them a lot through Santa Fe College Teaching Zoo. So it's just great partnerships, and they do a lot, and they have beautiful flying foxes that you can check out on their website. And my second organization is of the week is focusing more on flying foxes themselves. So there's a group out there called flyingfoxconservationfund.com. They also have a Facebook presence, and they're also a nonprofit organization, and I picked them because they're solely dedicated to protecting old world fruit bats or flying foxes and their habitat through conservation, education, and research. And they target research in countries such as Indonesia, the Solomon Islands, Madagascar, and Sulawesi. Oh, see, this is why I don't pronounce things.
Okay.
Anyways,
it's somewhere there.
Somewhere over there where flying foxes live. But they do really cool field programs. They work with biology students in out of Sumatra, and they want to help open more fruit bat rescues and rehabilitation centers on some of these islands where they're highly endangered. And they'd also like, they're working on having more education campaigns in the Solomon Islands because a lot of times they're hunted and sold as meat, and a lot of the species are highly endangered and need a lot of immediate action. So, yeah, I really recommend checking out Flying Fox Conservation Fund.
Yeah.
They do really unique things, and they're actually based out of Chicago, interestingly enough. So, yeah, their webpage has tons of information. Of course, you can donate and or contact them if you have more specific questions that we weren't able to answer today, because the gentleman that runs that organization is, he's kind of a world-renowned specialist in the flying fox.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, so, thank you for sticking with us today, just for us. So I just try to think, give us an idea of some species you want to cover. I mean, Angie and I have a million that we'd love to cover, and we have some really cool ones coming up for you. But give us an idea, post on our Facebook page some things we'll
leave a poll. A poll is a great idea. A little teaser is the species we'll be covering soon is a pick from my 4-year-old.
Yes.
Don't give it away. Yeah. Oh my gosh, if you can guess it, we should do something. Like if they can guess, if they listen to an old episode where I know I mentioned that this is what my 4-year-old wanted to do, and Chris and I decided it was great to do it. We will give you, we don't really have anything to give yet besides our love, but we will give you our shout out. Yep. If you want to email us or write us and guess what next week's species will be, that'd be really cool. But no, a poll's a really great idea, Chris, because for you and I, we're kind of excited about everything, which is why I talk so fast.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, Mom.
Sorry, Mom. Love you, Mom.
So anyway, subscribe, rate, and review, if you haven't yet. But thank you so much. We love that we have a following. And we're just going to keep doing this every day. Like, we're fighting for bats. We're fighting for ferrets. We're fighting for the vaquita porpoise. Fighting for those frogs. I'm fighting for elephants. Angie's fighting for rhinos. Niaga's fighting for catball langurs. Susan's for the Amazon River dolphins. Aaron for the polar bears. We love these people. We love you. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much for your time.
Listen. Learn. Share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.